physicist. Really, I'm interested in all kinds of physics, but what I spend most of my time on right now is trying to figure out what dark matter is, how elementary forces work, also how to find other elementary forces that we think may exist that could mediate dark matter interactions with us. And so I spend time thinking of experiments to do. I spend time working on some experiments at places like Jefferson Lab. You know, I travel to other labs talking to experimentalists. I do theory some fraction of the time. And I've been doing that now for a decade, roughly. So that's kind of roughly what I'm up to. And I guess you heard from Natalia yesterday.
And it's all a lot of fun. So, yeah. I don't know. Is that enough to get? Okay, you guys have some questions already. Great.
Excellent.
Go ahead.
So are all the buildings this great?
I'm sorry. I've probably spent like half an hour at least fangirling over the architecture.
Yeah.
Every single one is this great. So, some buildings are.
Sorry, you're asking about the. Just like literally the labs and the buildings and the facilities? A lot of experimental facilities are, you know, underground. Actually, my favorite experimental facility is, you got it. It's Snow Lab. Have you folks?
Yeah.
Right. Oh, all right then. So you know what I'm talking about.
But Snow Lab's great in a totally different way than PI is great, like, as a facility, right?
There's no windows.
no cool architecture, just, you know, really amazing that they made it work.
So did you go all the way into the lab? Did you go through the clean room process and took the showers and all that stuff?
Yeah.
You got the lab, like the lab clothing and all that. Okay.
We saw the corridor of Slope Snow Plus.
Excellent. Yeah. So did you peer through the window down in?
We have a little.
The viewport. Yeah. Doesn't it look like my reaction is it just looks like this ancient spaceship that they just uncovered, you know, buried. That's kind of what it looks like to me. But anyway,
But actually, I'm sure a lot's changed because we went there back like 4 years ago, and they've installed two or three new experiments. They started filling Snow Plus.
What did you see when you looked at the? Yeah, what does it look like now?
We have pictures that.
Okay. They were actually going down like into the hole now. There's no more like plexiglass window. They were like going down in there when we were.
Okay. Excellent. Yeah, because when we were there, there was okay. Things have changed
a lot. Another question?
I'm kind of wondering, is it possible to be like a serious physicist and still have a life outside of physics? And I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with like not having that, but like say like you want to be a physicist, but you also like want to have a family and also like play music or something. Like, I'm sort of just wondering, is that possible?
I think it is. So family asked me in a couple of months. so we're actually expecting our first kid this fall. And you know, so I've never done that before. Life, yeah. I think we have a life. We both have hobbies. We both enjoy the time we spend not doing physics.
But wouldn't you say that due to your moving reference frame, you wouldn't be able to see anything different?
So these things, you know, look, these things change with time. You know, I think when you're, especially when you're, there's a phase when you're a student where it's probably pretty important to really hunker down and focus. Because that's where you're laying a foundation for everything that'll come for decades to come. And I would say a lot of people I know were very, very, driven, ambitious, worked very, very hard, especially when they were at a graduate student level. So when they were working on their PhDs, when they were postdocs.
Right. Well, I worked really hard as a postdoc. But I mean, you know, you can work really hard and still have a life. But it's just that your sort of mindset about that life often changes to what are the things that I can do that give me like the most, I mean, recharging your mental energy is actually more important when you're working hard.
Yeah.
Right? So you ask yourself, what are the things that I really value that really help recharge me and that I can do in sort of limited time? And, you know, you end up doing as much of that as you can. So I once had at a previous one of these these things with the previous ISSYP, somebody asked me about like having two careers at the same time, like being a physicist, successful physicist, and a successful, I don't remember what it was, novelist, baker, something else. And I was like, yeah, you know, that I think like both of these things really require a dedication of more than, you know, well over 50% of your life. And, you know, you've got to sleep too. So not all at once. But hobbies, absolutely.
Yeah, and it is actually important to have some kind of balance, because you'll just drive yourself crazy if you don't.
And I mean, even at the times when I was working the hardest of all my life, there would be, you know, weekend trips to go hiking. There would be, you know, evenings when we just get together and do something fun. Movies, whatever, you know, sometimes this thing about picking the things that recharge you the most, I'm actually not very good at that. So I spend too much of my downtime doing things like watching TV that don't recharge me.
It's easy.
But sometimes I just need that complete break. Yeah.
What were you guys like in high school? Like, did you know you want to go into physics? And what did you like doing in high school? And what made you go into
physics? Right. So that's a good question. And I think for both of us, the answer is no, we didn't know in high school. But we both were starting to feel like physics was really cool in high school. So when I was in high school, I was pretty much thinking I probably wanted to be an engineer. And I had gotten really obsessed with physics as actually through a middle school book report was my sort of first exposure to the history of quantum mechanics. And I mean, I can go on and on about this, but there was this awesome book, 30 Years That Shook Physics, that was basically about all these different developments in the history of quantum physics. And it made me realize like, whoa, it made the whole subject seem a lot more approachable to me. Like even the biggest discoveries in the field have been made piecemeal by lots of people sort of putting in partially correct insights and then combining them with other people's. And as opposed to, I had very much before had this myth of like, you know, Einstein sits in the patent office and just has a great idea in a vacuum, which is more true of Einstein than it is of anybody else except possibly Newton. But even for Einstein and Newton, it's really not true. It wasn't in a, you know, it was, he was working in the patent office, but it wasn't a total vacuum. And so that somehow just made me feel like, oh, I can actually, you know, I don't know if I'm good enough to do this, but that sort of, in general, I still thought, well, you know, I'm not going to be one of these people that discovers brand new ideas. So, you know, so what's the point? And I actually had a very fatalistic attitude about pure science. And so that's why I sort of, but I loved it. So I thought, well, I should try to do some kind of engineering that lets me use that in my everyday life. And then it was sort of late in high school that I started taking some college classes, because my high school had this program where you could take a couple of college classes at a nearby university and in physics. And I liked those. And I was like, well, if these people can be physics majors, I mean, not that, I'm not trying to say they were sort of like me. I was like, okay, I can be a physics major too. And that sort of opened my eyes to the possibility that maybe, you know, I didn't have to be Einstein. I certainly didn't have to be Einstein yet in high school to do something interesting in physics. But it was really like first or second year of college that I sort of figured this is the direction I want to go.
Yeah, I didn't know that I wanted to go into physics in high school. I started out wanting to build aircraft. I still want to build aircraft. I mean, I just have an obsession with planes and flying and all that stuff. So physics actually came as an undergrad. I didn't even realize that physics was a profession when I was sort of in elementary, middle school, even up to early high school. It was actually, there's a picture of him back there, but The Brief History of Time, that book he wrote, that was actually my introduction to physics as a profession, which was kind of a fun introduction. And then I started thinking about it more and more. But the thing is, I sort of had this sense in high school and as an undergraduate that there's lots of cool, interesting, and fun things that could be done. And so I had trouble just totally zeroing in. At some point, I zeroed in on physics. But I look back and I think I could have zeroed in on any number of things, and it would have been fun, and it would have been fine. So I think, you know, there's no. It's not like physics is the pinnacle of what you could do, right? There's a lot of interesting things, even more interesting than physics that you could do. So just do your best at whatever you're doing.
Yeah, and find things that excite you, and you know, you don't have to find the perfect. Like honestly, I think there were probably two or three things that I could have gone into and would have enjoyed, and it was just sort of a question of like, where does the roulette wheel land? And it landed on physics, and I've been really happy with it. But I probably would have been happy with lots of other things.
And like, you'll get a sense of when you feel like you're good at something and when you can contribute to something. You know, I think when you start to feel that, then maybe you're on the right track. And if you don't feel that, then, you know, keep your options open, look at other things, be open-minded. So there was a question today, though.
You both kind of mentioned being interested in like engineering and things, and not to sound like totally ignorant, but like from a very distant perspective, engineering and physics are like more similar, than, for example, than like physics and creative writing or like painting or
yeah.
something. So, like, did either of you ever consider something radically different to physics, like outside of science?
I mean, I had a sort of like, I don't know what you call a midlife crisis in grad school, when I dreamed of opening a bakery, but I never like seriously pursued that.
Does wanting to be a pilot count as something radically? Anyway, that's about as far as I can go. No, not really.
I have friends that definitely did have more like more radical questions. Like, you know, one of my good friends in high school that I've actually lost touch with now, she was like, I don't know if I want to do chemistry or creative writing, which is pretty much, yeah. Pretty different. Actually, one of our writers here started out in, went to grad school in physics, did well, got her PhD, but decided, actually, her real passion was writing.
Have you met Erin Bo? No. Okay.
So,
she's awesome.
So there's definitely people that have like these two aspects, and you know, take some time to figure out what they want to do, but end up. And I mean, worst case. You spend a couple of years of your life doing something that you really like and then realize it's not your true passion. How bad is that? That's pretty good. So, yeah.
Just a question that I have in terms of, well, my parents are pushing me more towards the engineering side of things, even though I think I prefer the more pure research side of things. But the reason for that is financial stability. So I just wanted to ask, how financially stable is being a physicist with like university costs and everything afterwards?
What do you mean?
Are you asking us to predict the job market? Because I don't think we can do that.
No, that's someone's job.
Yeah.
Well, look, if you're good at what you do, you'll be fine. I think just at zeroth order, whether it's engineering or physics or something else, you'll be fine if you're good at what you do. Might you make more money? Are you asking about stability or?
I'm pretty sure my parents have this preconceived notion that being a physicist requires you living on $20,000 a year in this old shack. And even though I know that absolutely not the case,
right.
It's still this negative thought that perhaps it's not the most financially stable career, like perhaps you don't get paid enough.
So there's two things. There's stability and then there's how much you actually make,
yeah.
Right? So I think, I mean, I've never looked at the first thing to say is that if you look at what fraction of physics majors or even physics grad students actually like keep a career as traditional academic or research institution, you know, basic research physicists, it's low. A lot of people just get excited about something else and less excited about research as time goes on. And that doesn't mean they don't use their physics education, it means they use it differently. Either in some other applied context, or
they go into research and industry. By
or
the way.
Right,
as a whole,
so that's,
I mean,
most that's
R&D
what I meant
is not done by
context.
The federal government, you know, at labs and
yeah.
places like that. Right?
Well, so that's what I was calling an applied context.
Yeah.
Or they go into policy, or they go into some field that's not really related to physics, but still uses a lot of the sort of modeling and quantitative skills that you learn. So one thing is like. If you're really dedicated to, like, I want to do physics research, and you sort of, you know, you work hard at it, you follow your passion, and you're good, I think you can make that work. And financially, it's not bad. I mean, I think it's pretty good. It's not like being a Wall Street banker, which you can also do with a physics degree if you decide that you really, that money is more important to you than you realized.
I certainly have friends who went to work on Wall Street and then, helped cause the 2007-8 crash, and that's, it's fine. But
oh, come on. All our friends joined too little too late. Yeah. So. They just got blamed without actually contributing.
They got blamed. No, it's true.
So let's see. I had like 4 points. I lost track of them. So if you stay in academic physics, it's a pretty good life financially. I mean, you took out some college loans, had no problem paying them off during your postdoc. We were living in a pretty expensive place at the time. I think if you look at sort of average salaries for physics majors versus engineering majors, after, N years after college, the engineering ones are probably a little higher. I don't know. I mean, you can look this up. I haven't recently. I have no idea.
All this stuff.
But, if you ask, are you living in a shack on $20,000 a year?
Yeah.
Maybe as a grad student.
Look.
As a grad student, you're living in an apartment with a couple of roommates, $20,000 a year, and having fun and learning from them. And when you're young, that's totally fine.
I just got to say something. Yes, if you're not very good at what you do, and things are, and you're struggling, and if you're on that end of the spectrum, it can be difficult and not very stable. So let's just be upfront about that. If you're making contributions and you're pretty good at what you do, or you're even halfway decent, then what'll start to happen is you'll get pretty obsessed with whatever you're working on. If you find it interesting, you're going to care about that, and you're not going to care so much about what your darn paycheck is. It's because there's other things in life.
I mean, you'll care.
You want to make sure that you can eat and support yourself
and your
family,
and you'll have no problem
doing
that.
And then, but it's only going to but like that basic level, that's fine. There's not an issue in physics with that. It's enough to raise a family on for sure.
I've heard that the life cycle of a physicist is fairly set in stone, and that it's basically you get your PhD, do some postdoctoral work, and then basically join university until you get tenure, and then after that it's just publish or perish. So I was wondering what your opinion is on this. I've been told this by several different physics students.
Right, so what I just said, again, so that's one life cycle path that is pretty defined, right? There's lots of other things that you can do at any stage in that process, and that plenty of people end up doing. If your attitude personally is that anything short of a tenured professorship at the end of that process would be considered a failure, if that's your personal attitude, it's not mine, then you should know that there is a high chance of failure by that definition. If you want to, so let's see. Are there sort of deviations from that path that I can think of that eventually get you to that same destination? I don't think so. There are a ton of deviations that get you to different destinations that work very well for people.
Yeah, although
right? I mean, that's why I said I don't think it's a failure to not end up like teaching at a university for the rest of your life.
I do know that I've been told by several people that as soon as you start thinking about physics as a career, you probably should just quit. That advice has been given to me on several occasions. And it's true. It is not a conventional career at all. Yes, there's some promotions in academia, but I think like anything research related, what matters the most are the ideas you're having, how relevant they are to the real world. Like, you're going to measure your own success that way. If you're measuring your success by where you, kind of moving up the ladders, like, just quit. Because those people typically aren't contributing anything to the field. Just measure yourself by your ideas and contributions. The other stuff will follow. Like, it really will.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We hear a lot about the like success in physics, but how? What proportion of your time would you say is like moving forward on the problems you're thinking about, as opposed to kind of going in circles trying to find the next direction?
Most of the time you're wrong. Most of the time you're going in circles, and most of the time it's very difficult. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you have the hardest part about doing research is recognizing that that is okay, and that if you're not doing that, you're probably not aiming high enough, and you're not. I mean, it's just. A common piece of advice that was given to me, and I give it to the postdocs who work here and other people I talk to, is if you want to measure how well you're doing, you should ask yourself how many bad ideas have you killed, you know, in a given interval of time.
Yeah.
Because if you're not coming up with ideas that don't work out and killing them, then there's a problem.
Right.
You know, so it's
now obviously at some point then you the usual procedure is you want to be thinking of one, you know, at least for the kind of physics we do. The time scales will vary a lot from one like specific area to another. But you want to be thinking of like one or two bad ideas a week. And then eventually that means every year you've got like 100 chances to come up with a good idea, right? And so then you've got to be able to recognize the good idea and be like, okay, this is worth working on for a while. So then you stop coming up with bad ideas so that you can actually work on the good idea. And then you've got the forward and backwards. So my postdoc advisor used to refer to this process. He calls it fishing. I don't know why. And he used to often quote Winston Churchill that it's important to be able to move from one failure to the next with undiminished enthusiasm. And I think that's very true. And then you get to something interesting, and there's also a lot of just getting stuck.
But it's totally okay.
Yeah.
So I think there's a tendency, especially with people coming into research, to think that if you're not making sort of regular incremental progress on something, you're not doing it right. And if that's the way you think, there's this problem, which is that you then start to select things where you can make incremental progress, but only incremental progress, and there's really no, you know, you'll often choose things that have a low ceiling for discovery or a low ceiling for real genuine scientific opportunities because you can make more measured progress. That's fine. There are some things like that. I mean, actually, again, going back to balance, research should be balanced too. You know, you want to balance it with some really ambitious high-risk efforts, and then you also, it's a good idea, even just intellectually, to also work on things where you're more confident that you can make regular progress.
So, just as you mentioned, how do you actually, like, overcome the anxiety of producing no results for an extended period of time?
It helps to have mentors who will remind you often that that's okay.
Yeah.
It actually does. Like to have senior people in the field, you know, if you haven't written a paper in 6 months because you're really working hard on something, trying to make it, you know, work out, you start to get worried, especially when you're young and you're entering the field. Just a couple of times I've had people who I really respect tell me that's totally okay. That's, to be quite frank,
right.
That's because otherwise it's actually kind of scary. Because you'll hear other people, who, especially the more career-minded folks, who will talk about the numbers of papers and the numbers of citations and all the metrics.
But
that you gotta have
you
lined
were
up.
Into that your first couple of years of grad school.
Yeah, I had to be. I had to actually just kind of had that tendency to be.
Yeah.
Of course, it didn't help. My office mates were also providing. Anyway, it's
right.
Long story.
Yeah.
So I know that the corner answer is really big on collaboration, but are there times when you feel like better to work alone on something?
Absolutely, yeah. So there's actually, I think, a pretty healthy balance here. Like, the barriers to collaboration should be low. The barriers to just uninterrupted thought should also be low. I think that's really the philosophy that's embraced here and that I embrace. Sometimes you just need to, you know, sometimes talking about a problem is a distraction from just doing the hard calculations that you need to do. And you just need alone time. You need to just stare at that sheet of paper and be like, I don't know how to do this problem, but I've got to write down something. Otherwise, I'm never making any progress. And you keep working. And sometimes there's just, so that's the sort of, you know, what do I do? The place where it's really easy to just have writer's block. There's also just there's this chore that I need to get done so that I'll learn the answer. You know, I need to write a big program. I know exactly how to do it, but I have to spend a lot of time typing in the code. That kind of thing often too, and that's also solitary. right? Splitting that up among five people does, or talking about it doesn't help at all.
Yeah, I wanted to know about the travel opportunities. I know you have conferences all over the world. And so how often do you get to travel? How much time can you spend just visiting? And how much do you learn from those conferences?
There's a lot of travel, I think, in a, well, especially in particle physics, there's a lot of travel because it is an experimental science at the end of the day, and the experiments are spread out all over the world. I mean, just literally all, well, you know, Southeast Asia, North America, Europe, those tend to be the hot spots for where a lot of these experiments happen. But of course, you know, in astrophysics and astronomy, then you've also got like the South Pole, you've got Hawaii, you know, it grows even further. So yeah, you travel to conferences, you talk to folks, you exchange ideas, you learn about new results at a lot of these meetings. To be honest, you can overdo the travel. Some people do, because it takes a lot of time. But it is useful and it serves a purpose. I personally have mixed feelings about it. I definitely think there's a tendency there are some folks in the field I know who travel too much and it shows. Because, you know,
right. I mean, if you're spending too much time traveling to have new ideas to present at the conferences you're going to, you know, every 6 months or so, then you're probably spending too much time traveling and not enough time actually thinking.
I won't name names, but there's a particular conference in a particular location. It's not a conference, it's like a summer thing. And people go there, and the joke is that the people who go to that thing, they go there to talk about the ideas that the people who didn't travel the previous summer invented, you know, because they actually, anyway, so it's.
Yeah, but like outside of conferences, do you think you get a chance to kind of see the world? Like culture is more so than, you know, theoretical physics ideas.
Certainly, to the extent that you want to. I mean, it is, you know, it is busy, but yeah. So I mean, like personally, there was a time early in my postdoc when I was working closely with some people at CERN. And so I ended up spending like two months of the summer in Geneva. And we went basically every weekend. Every week we were working like, you know, 60-hour weeks with these people. Every weekend we would go to the airport, rent a small car, and drive someplace else in the vicinity for day trips, which is something I remember fondly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people who want to can definitely. So I feel like I've spent most of my travel time in North America and Europe, just through a combination of you know, that's where a lot of the conferences I find most interesting are, and also I do have a pretty high, like I generally don't like to go to Europe for just one trip if I can, one conference or something if I can avoid it. I feel like I should have enough work time there to justify the travel back and forth, and then if I can swing a weekend or something before or after, that's great. There have been a couple of times when we've actually just plugged a 1 week vacation at the end of a conference trip. And of course that's a lot easier for if you're either single or with somebody else in the same exact field.
But I mean, in terms of culture and being exposed to the world, the other element, it's not just the travel. I mean, physics, probably more than a lot of disciplines, but you know, I think, but in common with other areas of science, it's very, very international. I mean, there are people who work on these collaborations. This is more true probably in the experimental
side.
Right,
so you mean you meet people from all over the world,
and then they become your collaborators, and you get to know them. And you, I mean, it's just, that exposure is, you know, that's a kind of intangible side to doing physics.
Yeah.
You don't have to travel to places to kind of get a feeling for what the people are like.
Right.
And they'll talk about where they came from, and you learn a lot that way as
well. I mean, that's not unique to physics. Like, my dad's an engineer, and he has had the same kind of thing, where he's done projects, you know, in South Africa and Korea, and he meets people from there and keeps close to having touch with them over years.
Let's see. It'd be good to get somebody who has not asked a question yet. Go ahead.
Do you feel excited to go to work every morning? Like, are there times when you feel disillusioned about physics? And what do you do at those times?
Yeah, so there's a lot of days when I feel excited. And I don't want to start sounding negative without saying that first. There's definitely days when it's really tough, when you just feel like you're not making progress, so why bother? and just kind of, or, you know, there's something that you know you need to do to make progress, but that's not sort of actively fun, right? Both of which just require a certain amount of willpower to get over them. So having colleagues really helps with that, because I feel like even if I'm not excited about the work that I'm going to do one day, if I at least think, well, maybe I'll have some interesting conversations, I like the people I work with, that can sort of help re-energize you. And just putting it in perspective that, you know, you go through times when, you know, like there were times when I felt demoralized and so I just didn't work for a while. And there were times when I felt demoralized and I got some work done anyway and good things came of it. And then you just sort of, you know, learn from those experiences and internalize that actually, you know, it's worth pushing forward even when you're demoralized, because you feel better afterwards. And that's the only way to break out of it. I think probably in any career, it's a very pragmatic thing. You just sort of learn that pushing through it is the best way forward.
But I think in theoretical physics, though, especially if you are working on harder problems, there's definitely days where you feel demoralized because you start to doubt that you'll actually figure out what you're trying to answer. I mean, and I think on those days you go in, and one good way to deal with it is you talk to your colleagues and you try to learn something from them, you know, and learning about how the world works is fun, or learning what other people are learning or their ideas, that's fun, and that usually re-energizes me at least. So it's not so bad.
Sometimes when you actually really go forward, the field of physics kind of really narrow. So two people may came up with the same idea. Does that like happen often?
Yes.
Yeah. I usually try to work on projects where I think that's not likely to happen, or at least projects where I'm pretty sure that there won't be three people coming up with the same idea. Because if there's three people coming up with the idea, even two, really, I might as well work on something else. Let them figure that out and find something that's you know, that's really cool and different and my own. I think, at least for me, I think a lot of the narrowness of the field is really a question of how creative people are trying to be. If you ask a slightly different question than everybody else is asking, then there's a good and a bad side to that. The bad side is you don't have as many people who are sort of really excited about your work, who really want to talk to you about it, who cite your paper, so you sort of get less attention. But then on the other, but in the long term, you're actually broadening what it means to do that kind of science, which is pretty darn cool. And to me, you know, worth more than the flattery of my colleagues.
Yeah, I mean,
that's the direction that I tend to go.
At any given time, there'll be some number of directions that look promising, and there's a tendency for a lot of people to work on the same direction, and so it's then very common that they'll have, you know, the same idea or variants of the same idea all at the same time. And there's also a tendency for people to have the same idea, and then like 5 years later, they'll have that idea again, not realize somebody it was had, and then, you know, five more. I mean, you know, that sort of thing happens, right?
And then there's cases where people really do have a sort of genuinely new idea, but it involves combining a couple of things.
Yeah.
And actually somebody else is having the same, a very similar idea at the same time. And that's fine. I mean, you know, many of the breakthroughs in, would I have been ashamed to invent the, like, so what is it? Dirac and Slater both worked out some of the sort of essential laws of quantum mechanics right around the same time. I learned that there was this famous big unsolved Hilbert problem in math that Turing and another guy whose name I don't remember solved at exactly the same time. And like, would I be sad to have come up with either of those ideas because somebody else did at the same time? Absolutely not.
What's sad is right? What's sad is spending all your the only yeah. If you want to again try to put it nicely. having a good idea at the same time as somebody else, who cares? Nobody cares about that. It's fine. Having, you know, kind of mediocre ideas at the same time as everybody else, you know,
who cares?
Nobody
cares about that.
Nobody cares about
in the other sense.
Right, I mean, so anyway.
Let's
see. We haven't had any questions from the back of the room. There we go.
So what was the most challenging part in your career as a physicist?
Most challenging part?
Working on what are known as simplified models. Because that was something that early on there was just a hell of a lot of opposition to. And we were grad students. So just in a nutshell.
All right. So yeah, so that was a case of something that's, I guess, that was challenging because you sort of had to stick to your gut and stick to your guns in the face of a lot of negativity. I think for me, probably the most existentially challenging time for me was early in my postdoc when I had just moved. As a grad student, I was surrounded by a group of people that I knew that were exchanging ideas. My advisor was sort of very outgoing and enthusiastic and constantly talking to us all about new ideas. And it was sort of understood that most of his ideas he wasn't going to pursue because he didn't have, you know, he had more ideas than time. But that if any of the students wanted to pursue them, that, you know, and actually develop them into something that made sense, that, you know, that he would be very happy to talk about them. And then I moved into a sort of slightly different culture of interactions in my postdoc, and there was this pressure of, okay, now I have to do something really new. I don't want to just keep doing exactly the same research I did as a PhD student. How do I actually start working on something new? What do I want to work on? And it just sort of seemed wide open and a little overwhelming. And then I hadn't quite figured out the dynamics of the group of people that I was working with to see, okay, how do I actually exchange and help develop and, you know, develop ideas collaboratively with them. And so those two things at the same time were a little overwhelming.
There's a good person there. Blue shirt. Well, or striped shirt, either one.
I was just wondering when you found out about like what your passion within physics was, but like when did you figure out you wanted to more focus on particle physics? And like if you do that, can you sort of combine other aspects of physics within your experiment as well, or maybe change your mind later on?
Oh, you could definitely change your mind. You can move from things. I mean,
and combine things. People do that all the time. I mean, for us, I think the sort of for me the most the two stages most analogous to that were when I went from really, I mean, it's always sort of been, I've always sort of been in particle physics, but in terms of like, I started out really as a theorist, sort of model building, never really felt like I was hitting my stride there, and then getting more involved with experiments and realizing that I could contribute to experiments either sort of from the periphery or by actually proposing new ones. That was a pretty big change. In mindset relative to sort of the way the lines of the fields are drawn. People tend to think of experimental theory as something you choose right at the beginning of grad school. And I chose theory. And then 4 years later, I was spending most of my time with experimentalists. And like, when I look back at my mentors, I have my theory mentors and my experimental mentors that, you know, only the theory mentor was my actual PhD advisor. But I've got two experimental mentors that I view as like people I'm, you know, comparably close to, that have had a comparable impact on my career, even though I still think of myself as a theorist, work at a theory institute and all that stuff.
Yeah, but you should definitely be prepared to, you know, keep an open mind, combine things. It's good for the field, you know, it's good for science in general. Like when you, especially for young people coming into the field, when you come in, you know, yes, you'll see a sort of state of affairs, and don't pay too much attention to the state of affairs.
Yeah.
Like you should do what you think makes sense. And if it means turning the, you know, if it means just ignoring barriers that have grown up for historical reasons, then just, you know, screw it. Just
do
two things at once if you need to.
If you have ideas that sort of combine or interests that sort of stem from two different areas and you combine them, then yeah, maybe you're doing something a little bit unconventional, but honestly, you are breathing new life into your field.
Everybody will love you.
And you know.
No, it's true. I mean, just because new directions, especially when they cross between two different boundaries, they don't come along that often. But
yeah.
Everybody talks about them. I mean, it's there's just incessant talk of interdisciplinary collaboration and breakthroughs and things like that. The truth is, it doesn't happen that often.
Right.
So when it
and
you
if
know,
you try to force it, you often get junked out.
Yeah.
But if you
can do it,
if it's because you're really interested in A and you're really interested in B and you learn both well and you find an interesting new way to combine them, then I'm not trying to exaggerate. You're breathing new life into your field.
Yeah.
And
possibly more than one field.
So you said earlier how during your graduate studies there was sort of some opposition to the ideas that we were coming up with in the field. I just wanted to know, like, do you see this as sort of becoming a barrier for new ideas sort of having to defend?
It has always been the case that new ideas encounter opposition. I didn't realize that when I was a student, and so I kind of took it, you know.
Personally?
I almost took it personally. And then I started reading a little bit about the history of science and the history of physics in particular. And oh my gosh, just the,
right.
Oh yes, it's
well,
not a special case.
And we were lucky also that both Joe and Nima had sort of stories of overcoming.
Yeah.
So these are one theory, one experiment mentor that we were talking, just our old PhD advisor and this experimentalist that we had just started talking to, both had stories of like, really good ideas that became hot in the field that faced spectacular opposition early on. And they were just like, yeah, I've seen this before. In fact, you have no idea how much worse I saw it.
Yeah, we had it easy.
So that certainly helps.
But I don't think that's changed with time.
Yeah.
I still want to get, okay, so how about, let's come back to you. Then we got to hear from this side of the room, the back. Go ahead.
Okay. Just a simple question. You said you were programming quite a lot, and I wonder what language you use.
Whatever's convenient at the time. I mean, a lot of physics programming, you're building off of code that somebody else wrote. And so if you're trying to adapt some Fortran code, guess what? You're coding in Fortran.
The question would be, what should we learn?
Just learn to pick up new languages quickly.
Yeah, understand the structure.
Yeah.
I mean, if you can find like a good intro, I mean, well, for now, just learn something and learn how to like design. I think in terms of if you're learning programming, probably the best thing is just learn how to design something from scratch, how to think about it, reflect on what you've done. Like if you're learning C and doing a C project, then write it, and then be like, if I had to write this all over again, what would I do differently? I think that's actually a good lesson for everything that you're learning, is just you should always reflect on what you've learned from the process, and if you're writing things where you're like, oh, I did that exactly the right way, I was perfect, then that means you're not challenging yourself enough. And then if you've learned one language and you feel like, okay, you basically know how to use it, you do some project that you're interested in. The other thing is you think about, like, this is a project that I think would be cool. Depending on that project, it might be a good project to learn shell scripting with. It might be a good project to learn object-oriented programming with. It totally depends. And that can guide you to what to learn. And then if you can learn something about just sort of more generally the structure of programming, down the road, I think that's pretty useful. But you know, really, you learn by doing, by talking to other people about it, and by reflecting on what you've done.
Okay, good. How about you? Yeah.
In physics, we have a lot of questions that we haven't answered yet. So, which one are you like the most excited to know the answer to?
Good question.
All of them.
Okay, I'll just be very honest. It's not physics. I mean, sorry.
No, go for it.
So I
know what you're gonna say.
So I want to know if there's life in the universe other than ours. Just to be totally frank with you, just like that's kind of almost at the top of my list of scientific questions that I want to know the answer to. And then just below that, I actually really want to understand what the rest of the universe is built out of, namely what dark matter is, because that's most of the matter of the universe. And it could actually be fantastically interesting. And it, I think it could very well tell us quite a bit about fundamentally how we fit into the grand scheme of things, like where the standard model comes from, what a sort of more complete picture for the origin of the universe is, and so on. And I think until we solve that problem, we're going to be just purely speculating about that. So one's physics and one is not. Yeah, whatever. It's all science, though. Do you have?
Yeah, I think for me, one of the things that I'm really excited about, which is an example of one of these questions that people didn't really even ask that much. Like, it wasn't one of the canonical questions 10 years ago, is this question of, okay, are there other kinds of forces? Is there other stuff out there that's not necessarily stable? Like, there's, what is most of the matter in the universe stable that's around right now made of? And then there's just, what's most of the laws of nature? When we look at the standard model, is that basically almost it, at least at low energies, or is that the tip of an iceberg? And we have yet to see 9/10 of it. That's a question that I find really exciting that nobody really tried to ask systematically until several years ago.
Let's see. Have you asked a question? No. Okay, go.
So, like, taking into account the current situation of physics, would you say a double major with physics and computer science is better than physics and math?
It totally depends on what area of physics you want to go into and what you enjoy. So if you find I was a physics and math double major. And a lot of the more advanced math classes that I took, I don't use on a regular basis at all. But I still think that I enjoyed learning about that stuff and that it helped. Actually, for me, I think the biggest effect of being a math major is that was the context where I first encountered solving, like, challenging myself with really hard problems, where I just needed to sort of look around the edges of the problem for a way in and find it, was in some of my more abstract math classes. And that's a skill that is really hard to learn, really important for research. I needed to sort of retool it in order to apply it to physics research, but I built it as a math major, and I have no regrets about that. So I've gone through periods when my research involves computing stuff a lot, periods where it involves none of that. And I've never done anything that requires, like, major system architecture. So doing, like, a computer science major, I think, would have been at least, in the sense of, like, directly applying. So I didn't do a computer science major, but I'm pretty sure I know what topics my computer science major's friends learned, and I don't think any of that. I took a basic electronics class and the introductory programming class at my university, and I wrote some programs for fun. And I don't think, beyond that, I don't think any of the skills that they learned in their class, like the literal skills that they learned in their classes, would have been any more useful to me as a physicist than the literal skills I learned in my math classes, which is to say they were both useless. Now, I mentioned for me, my math classes taught me a way of thinking and a way of approaching problems that was really useful. If I had been a CS major, that might have done the same thing, and I have no idea because I wasn't a CS major. And in terms of, but, so that's maybe a roundabout way of saying, do things that excite you, that you find intellectually challenging and engaging, and don't worry about, is this class going to have applications to what I'm doing later? Because honestly, I think, I mean, you can worry a little bit about that, but I think that's the wrong question. The more question is, does it prepare me to, you know, to engage with the kinds of problems that I'm likely to engage with later? And if you're finding the classes engaging, then it will, right? Because then you're going to gravitate to the same kind of thing later on, in terms of what problem-solving skills it uses.
Yeah. So the thing is, the thing is I'm sure plenty of people have said this, but the main thing you should focus on is learn to think, learn to be productively critical. the things that will probably, you do need to sort of, you know, it's important to have a good foundation. So you should learn the basics well, and you should master the basics in whatever you're going to do. And in all likelihood, the things that are probably most important to you in whatever profession you go into are probably not in your textbooks.
Yeah.
And you're going to learn them after you've gone through college. So.
Right. Or on the side in ways that you didn't really predict. Yeah. So it's fine to be interested. By the way, if you're like, if you just approach it as, well, I'm going to, you know, I don't, I'm just going to be a physics major, but I'm going to take lots of electives that I find exciting.
It's fine.
And that'll be spread among three different fields. Totally fine.
Who cares about the double major?
Nobody's gonna look at you and say, I mean, I've looked at grad student applications, and I don't say, oh, she was a double major and she only got a physics major. I do look at, did this person challenge themselves? Did they take advanced courses? Did they do well in them?
Well, I look to see if somebody
demonstrate
their
knowledge to use. Yeah, do they put it to use? Do their professors say that, like, that they caught on to things quickly, that they asked really good questions, and that they went to town on some of the extra credit projects and really showed a lot of creativity in how they approached this or that. Not at whether they got a double major or not. So don't feel like you have to choose, like, I'm going to spend 100% of my time on these two things so that I can get my double major. If that's what makes sense for you, you happen to get a second major, cool. If not, cool.
Was there another question in the back there? I think there was, yeah.
Can you describe kind of a typical day, working day?
Like, I don't think there's a typical day. But,
yeah. No day is quite typical.
What you do during the day.
Some days involve a lot of meetings with collaborators, often on Skype or something like that, where we're talking through projects that we're working on. You know, and it's very, you know, those are sort of more predictable days. There's other days, especially in periods of time where I'm quote unquote fishing, meaning I'm trying to start something new, where I'll be talking with colleagues or reading papers or just doodling, either on a chalkboard or on a notepad, and I'll spend a lot of time doing that. Not doodling, but like talking and trying to learn things from I doodle too, but from colleagues. So that's a totally different kind of day. So it really, I don't know, it really varies.
Right, there's days of just working hard on some task.
Yeah.
And again, that could be either the sort of, well, you know, and often talking to one or two close collaborators on whatever project you're working on about progress, like twice or three times in the day, but you're basically just working by yourself. And then here's what I found. Does that make sense to you? There's days when a group of us are sitting in front of a blackboard most of the day doing sort of real-time calculation, order of magnitude calculations. And
those are fun
days. Or trying to understand what somebody else did.
Yeah.
In an order of magnitude way, sort of checking each other's work.
No, the really fun times though are when you've got a new idea, you're not sure if it's going to work out, and so you're frantically working with whoever you're working with, and maybe just yourself doing the calculations, and you're wondering, like, literally, what's around the corner? Is the idea going to survive? Is it going to die? You know, then it survives, and you're like, okay, next step. Is it going to survive? Next step. You know, and that's a lot of fun. Those days are not super common. They're not totally uncommon, but. Just because at this point, like speaking for myself, I have a lot of ongoing projects now that are, of course, the result of good ideas from the past, but they start to take up more and more of your time, and so then you slow down coming up with other ideas. But... Okay, let's see. I just want to make sure there was one other. Yes, we'll come back to the front. Go ahead. Yeah.
Oh, can I ask more than one?
Go ahead. Why not?
Okay. So. So, a basic. So one basic one, another more personal. So how do you convince someone to fund your project, even though it might be impractical or like not promising? Like, how do you convince someone to fund your project like that?
To fund it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, you have to believe it's promising.
Yeah, you have to believe it's promising, and then. It's not that complicated. It's actually, you know, first of all, you have to be convinced that it's worthwhile. That's probably the most important and sometimes most difficult step.
Yeah.
And then you just have to be very, very straightforward with all the folks around you. You know, what is the idea? What are the promises? You know, what are the discovery potentials, and so on? What are the risks? You know, just be very upfront that maybe things won't work out. And I have found, you know, surprisingly good reactions to that. I think most people realize in basic research that things don't, you know, there's risks, there's discovery opportunities. And I think as long as you're straightforward about it, it's not that big of a deal. I mean, you have to work at it. You have to be, you know, you have to articulate the ideas clearly.
Yeah, I mean, look, you have, you know, all of these funding agencies, they're funding more than one project at once, right? You are living one life. Every day, you have only 24 hours. So the bar for you to say, I think, you know, I think this is really important and worth doing for me, you know, don't ignore that. That's a pretty high bar, and you should always make sure that you reach it. That you might feel like some projects are worthwhile because you know you'll learn something kind of interesting either way. Or other projects are worthwhile because they might fail, but if you succeed, you'll learn something spectacularly interesting from it. And so it's worth the try. And either one of those cases you can make to a funding agency, or, you know, or obviously there's a lot in between. You can make that case to a funding agency. You make the case that no matter what, there's certain things that, you know, certain technical skills that will be acquired, right? That the students you're working with on this project will learn something from it. That in the best case scenario, you will learn something really transformative about the universe from it. And then in the worst case scenario, you know, whatever it is, right? But you convinced yourself to work on it. And if you keep your standards high, then you can convince somebody else that they should support it too.
Yeah. If you set your own standards high, then the rest of it is, it's not easy, but it is much more straightforward than you would
And
think.
I'm not trying to say that, like, if you submit a grant application, it gets rejected. Means you suck and your ideas sucked and you have no judgment. Might be that your priorities in that particular agency just don't see eye to eye.
That's not a big deal, though.
But again, there's more than one agency you can apply to. Maybe you need to refine your case. Maybe there are parts of the project that you needed to develop more before you're ready to ask for money, and that's fair. But you can keep working on it. And generally, there's a lot of, I mean, you're not the first person to try to do this, and there's a lot of infrastructure in place to help people, like, get through these funding lows.
You said you had a personal question, though.
Right. How do you develop taste in physics, or more generally in science? Good taste.
I can't say that my own taste is great, so. I think at the end of the day, you should ask yourself, okay, it really depends on the subject, like the particular area in physics. I know that, you know, there's a sort of particular kind of taste that people talk about in what's known as model building in theoretical physics, where you construct models of, say, the weak interactions or dark matter or things like that. You literally just construct mathematical models. And there's sort of a set of guidelines that the community has sort of built up over the years for what constitutes a model with good taste. Okay, that's one category of taste. And there's a totally different set of criterion if you're thinking about new experiments. You know, does your experiment have the ability to self-calibrate? You know, does it have the ability for you to, you know, measure the backgrounds with the same apparatus and not have to rely on outside theory or measurements? You know, there's different kinds of things that determine what's good taste when thinking about it, designing an experiment. So I don't know. I don't think I have a good answer for your question.
If there's somebody, so I think one part of it is keeping your own, you know, your own standards high, remembering that your time is the most valuable thing you have. And ask yourself, you know, think about it. So I think this is one thing. Some people really think about, is this problem worth my time? You know, is this a good problem to work on? Should I be doing something else? And it worries them. And other people don't. And if the more, you know, I mean, you don't want to become, like, paralyzed by it, obviously. If you're spending 90% of your time second-guessing what problems you're working on, that's not good. But you do want to have that sort of introspective self-judgment side turned on and listen to it. And that's a big part of it. And then if there are people around you that you think have some aspects of good taste, like you think, oh, they had a nice idea, and they're sort of in a field related to yours, you know, start talking to them about their ideas, about your ideas, about other people's ideas, and you learn things from what they say. right? And talking about other people's ideas is especially good just because, you know, they can be blunt without any pride of anybody involved in the conversation being risked. And you're just like, yeah, I read this paper. I thought it was interesting. What did you think about it? And maybe they say, oh, well, it would be great. But, you know, the problem with that kind of thing, I've seen it 100 times and such and such. And they'll be really frank, perhaps more frank than they'd be if you asked them to criticize your idea or their own idea. And you learn something from it that you can apply yourself later on.
Okay, so now we'll... So there's no new questions back there?
Yeah. So you've had your hand
okay.
up for a long time.
This is kind of a personal question, but you said that you considered being a baker, and I'm kind of wondering how physics shapes you like as a person. So how do you think you would be different as a person if you had pursued baking?
I probably work very different hours. And everything that entails. I don't know. I mean, that's a good question, but yeah. You stumped me.
Yeah.
How do you think you'd be different? I mean, you considered building planes more seriously than I considered being a baker. But still different.
I don't know.
Sure?
I haven't really. Yeah, I'm not sure that it would have changed me that much. I mean, I think my work would be a lot more scripted, just because I know in practice, you know, aeronautical engineering is a very. I don't know. It's changed in recent years because, of course, now there are these startups trying to develop new technologies for, you know, replacing the space shuttle and so on and so forth. So maybe, you know, maybe there's room for a lot of new ideas there, but otherwise it would probably be a very scripted kind of work.
Can I ask a different question?
Yeah. Stumpers don't count. Go ahead.
I know that I'm kind of addressing this to people who have succeeded in science, but like from the outside looking in, it kind of like there's this perception that it's very male dominated as an area. And then I always kind of thought that it was more so just like you're intelligent or that like you're contributing, it doesn't really matter who you are. But then there are people like Tim Hunt who kind of come out with these like shocking comments.
Right.
And I was wondering what's realistic.
So are you basically asking whether it's fair to whether the
yeah,
field
or,
is
like,
fair
are
to women?
You know?
So I think what she's asking is how sexist the field of science.
Okay,
yeah.
Right. So I can only speak to my own experiences. I have never worked with anybody who made sexist comments to me. There have been times when I've felt like a older male called. Then this is actually the exception. And it's people that I still work well with, by the way. Sort of didn't listen as much to my ideas, or tended to defer decision making. If there was a group of us, tended to defer decision making to the sort of in consultation to the male members of the group more than to me. So at the level of sort of day-to-day work and interactions, I have felt that kind of thing sometimes, not the norm, but sometimes. And you have to learn to cope with it and to just be like, all right, well, you know, he's losing out on my ideas. That's fine. You know, find ways to go around that so that your ideas still get into the process because you care about the project too. And again, that is in my experience at least, that is the exception. I have occasionally third hand heard some like sort of dismissive sexist comments about other people, which always annoys me. I think it's too idealistic to say that it's just the quality of your ideas that counts. I think there is a lot of presentation, self-promotion in the field that does kind of matter. I mean, if you're doing something new, then even though all your other colleagues are sort of are experts in the field in some sense, you still need to explain your ideas to them and at some level sell your ideas to them. And, well, obviously, if they're, you know, if some of them are intrinsically less receptive to that because you're female, then you do need to sell the ideas better than your male counterparts do to convince those people. Or just convince the people that aren't sexist, and most of them will invariably be male, and eventually the ideas will get out. But you know, I mean, presentation is important. Convincing other people, articulation of ideas is really important. And I think there's... I personally was really helped by the fact that my PhD advisor sort of... Well, I mean... Our field, like the culture of theoretical physics, is really quite, I don't know, aggressive sends the wrong message, but it's extremely assertive. People tend to talk loudly, interrupt each other, get really excited about things. It's just how we work. I didn't really realize this until I was, as a postdoc, working with a young, shy Singaporean grad student who was awesome. Sorry, not Singaporean, Malaysian, right?
Malaysian.
And at some point, you know, I was being my obnoxious self that had evolved over the course of grad school. And at some point, she was just like, you know, I like this project, but I can't deal with our interactions. And... And that was the wake-up call when I realized sort of, you know, what I had become and that I could still turn it on and off at appropriate times and that, you know, but I also think that learning how to behave that way at the right times and to not be afraid to just interrupt other people and make sure my voice was heard, which was definitely a skill that I acquired through the deliberate interventions of my advisor. Because he would, like, we'd be talking, and if I started talking and he talked over me, he would, like, say, back off and say, no, and force me to say whatever I had to say. So then I just interrupted him because it was less awkward. that's something that's not a gender issue per se, but definitely is, I think... The way that it's more like the way that it's at least among North American women, North American men, it is more reflect the culture is more reflective of the way North American men typically interact and are used to interact, accustomed to interacting, than the way that North American women are accustomed to interacting. And it took some adjustment, and then it took some disadjustment when I realized I'd probably taken it too far. but you know, that's also part of the sort of self-promotion side of things.
Personal question. You said that you are quite interested in aerospace engineering, and I'm quite interested in that field. But as a high school student, it is very hard for me to find any resources in that field. For example, as a high school student, we cannot go to NASA or JPL. So how do you learn this kind of knowledge in order to pursue your passion?
I am not sure that I've got a precise answer to that question. I don't know. So of course, all of these places that you mentioned have programs. I know they have summer programs. I don't know the details though. Now, as a college student from any number of different places, then the summer programs and internships and things like that in all these areas really open up. But at a high school level, I'm less sure.
Yeah.
I think that's probably going to open up more, though, when you get into university.
But there's no harm done in either, you know, trying to just ask people there, like this if they have an outreach group, for example, that might be a good contact place to start. I'm really interested in this. Do you or any other, you know, do you have any programs for high school students there where I could get involved? Do you know of any place else in the field that does?
Yeah, especially the public.
And that takes a lot of time. But like, I'm sure that, that JPL has an outreach office.
Well, NASA for sure.
And NASA that have that wouldn't necessarily offer what you're interested in, but might help you get some leads into places that do.
But what about the resources?
In terms of just learning?
The books you read or online courses like that.
Again, well, there's a lot of stuff online that's available, but again, you could start with the outreach groups in either NASA or JPL or any of the other aerospace labs. And I strongly suspect they would be able to point you towards something to look at.
And another thing you can try to do is look at, like, so a lot of these online universities are starting to offer these online open course projects, so that you can at least listen to some university lectures. And that might be a step where you realize, wow, there's a lot of background that I need to understand the university course that I don't have yet. But then actually figuring out what that, trying to figure out for yourself, what is it that I need to learn to understand these lectures and how do I get there, is a really great experience. So I know, for example, the MIT's sophomore year, second year, unified engineering class for aerospace, I'm pretty sure is available online. I think I looked at this because I thought it would be interesting to try to like peruse it at a cursory level while I was working out. And then I realized that was hopelessly naive, that I just couldn't even pay attention while I was working out. And I didn't have the time while I wasn't working out, so I dropped it. But I'm pretty sure a lot of these things are...
Another thing you might try... You could always look at aerospace. So I mean, if you have questions about access to resources getting into aerospace, if you can identify individuals who you could email to ask, either that's why we've already mentioned sort of the outreach groups at NASA or JPL. But if it's like university programs that have programs in aerospace research or something like that, you can always just literally email professors there. Mention you're a high school student, because if you just get I just know, speaking for myself, if I get a random email from somebody, it doesn't usually, but high school students have a special place, and so there's anyway, just say who you are, that you're trying to learn more about the field. Come back here.
Can you tell us more about your PhD experience? Like, I don't know, both of you completed your PhD at Harvard, so like, how was your experience, and like, what did you learn from it, and what were some of the challenges that you faced?
I mean, there was like a, I don't know, that's a good question.
Either I've repressed the memories of most of the challenges, or it was a lot of work but overwhelmingly fun. I'm not sure which.
I remember the part for me, the fun part actually was that there were a lot of things that I was doing, like, okay, so for example, the aspect of... you start doing research in your PhD program. That's usually there's summer internships and undergraduate research opportunities and things like that. But that's totally not the same as really getting into research when you're a graduate student. So there was that whole phase of things that I really liked. And it was just a totally different way of spending my time. There were no problem sets. There were nothing like that. It was just like, sit down and there's no textbook. Maybe there's a few papers to look at for guidance, but it's just, wide open. How do I tackle this problem? And trying to learn how to do that was a lot of fun. That's one thing I certainly remember. You're also in this usually with other people. I know at Harvard they did this thing that was very good, which was they stuck all of the first years in all of the different areas, experimentalists, theorists, condensed matter, high energy people. I mean, just everybody all got stuck
all
into the same
office
space.
Like four to an office with this big common area that we all would get together and talk about. And a lot of us were taking the same classes. So we'd talk about our problem sets there. We'd talk about our, our anxieties about finding advisors there.
Yeah.
Actually, the first repressed memory came back to me is that when I started grad school, there was this, like, huge anxiety that I had that I talked a lot to him about and a lot to a bunch of other people about basically the fact that the class before ours had just happened to have, like, a ton of theoretical particle physicists that accepted. Like, they were used to having half the class accept, and that year, all the class accepted. And so a lot of the people who we went to visit were like, you better watch out, because nobody's going to have room to advise anybody, because there's just too many students here right now. And so we were like, is there an advisor crisis? Should we not go to Harvard because of this advisor crisis? And then eventually we talked with our future supervisor, and he was like,
yes, there was an advisor crisis, but it didn't matter.
And I mean, there was an advisor crisis. He had like 7 or 8 students at a time, which he later admitted was far too many, even for his style of advising. But
what about the office thing? Oh yes.
Right.
So we had a somewhat unusual thing, which is that there was a bit of politicking going on, having to do a long story, but we ended up, so the way it's supposed to work is when you get an advisor, you know, you change your location, you're supposed to get an office. I mean, it's a little tiny office, you usually share it, but there was no space. This is in part because of this large class that had come in ahead of us. So we had this unusual experience where when we first moved up to the area where, you know, the theorists were, we had literally no workspace, no office, no nothing, no desk, no place to put anything, you know, just not even a space to write. So at first we tried using, there was this little attic space with a table, and we tried using that. But then, you know, there was this thing about, well, you know, people aren't supposed to use that. It's supposed to be a public space, blah, blah, blah. So then the professors in the department started just volunteering their offices when they were traveling. So then we went from no office to using like these full-blown, you know, professor offices with, you know, these nice desks and all, you know. Polished wood. So that was kind of bizarre and kind of unusual. Worked out okay.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, for me, I also remember the transition from being like, so for us, the first years all had these offices together. Then when you became a second year, you moved up to this other group of offices. And then sometime in your second year, you were supposed to take your qualifying exam and join a group. And at that point, get kicked out of your second year office. Which was where this crisis came from. But it meant that we sort of had this peer community that was defined, that was a little, you know, it was intellectual, but also a little more social. We were all coming in together, shared experiences, and different research interests. And then we sort of transitioned very abruptly from that to hanging out with a research group, which meant basically everybody else there had been there longer than we had, you know. The group we were eating lunch with was half older grad students, half postdocs and faculty. And there were all these technical discussions, and like people would spend the whole lunch hour talking about the details of some projects that they were working on. And it just, for me actually, at first it felt really socially isolating. I was like, I mean, now I do that myself. But before I had that sort of knowledge base to do it, it just felt, I remember telling him, like, man, I just don't like eating lunch with these people. They're, you know, all they do is talk about these little technicalities of their papers. And of course, that's not all they do. Sometimes they talked about other, you know, other larger ideas. And as I got more exposure to it, more experience, I started, A, recognizing when they were talking the real details of shop and when they were talking about interesting new ideas, and became able to at least participate at the level of asking questions, and then gradually, you know, engaging more and more in the discussions. But that was sort of an emotionally tough transition for me, from the intellectual but still more socially oriented cohort of my class to really working, like really being a member of this research group.
Then there was the first trip to CERN. That was awesome. That was definitely awesome.
Yeah. But yeah, on the whole, I mean, it was a lot of work. I guess the other thing was, as I started getting more into research, trying to figure out how to adjust my work-life balance. I was like, man, I was really into cooking. I had a lot of friends in the area, and I'm like, how do I balance this stuff? You know, I can't exactly cook dinner for myself if I'm working on a project until 8 at night, and then I'm just too hungry. and sort of dealing with life adjustments associated with that.
Okay. We'll just slowly work our way that way. Yeah, we'll start here.
Harvard's architecture in comparison to here.
Right. Yeah. we were in a recently renovated space at the time. I liked it. There was a little, I mean, I don't think it's as cool as here, but, you know, there was this cool sort of top floor balcony area where a bunch of us went illegally onto the roof deck, and it was fun.
Okay,
so it seems that throughout undergrad and postgrad, you need to keep focusing down to a specific area of physics if you want to go into physics. But how long can you keep doing things like debate or writing that are far removed from physics? Like, how long can university or you keep devoting time
to? I knew people who kept up some of their hobbies for sure, whether it was playing instruments or involvement in, you know, activist groups.
We have a friend who took poetry, like advanced poetry classes through grad school. Writers' workshops, things like that. A lot of colleagues who are still pretty serious pianists. Piano seems to be the most popular instrument among physicists, as far as I can tell.
Oh. I have no idea. Selection effect.
Yeah, probably.
I don't think it's that too hard.
Yeah.
I've noticed that you did your PhD under Nima Arkani-Hamel.
Yeah.
I was just wondering, like these physicists we hear about all the time, what are they like in real life?
Well, this is being taped, so.
Yeah, ask me about it now.
We can talk about it at lunch.
Yeah. No, but I mean,
Nima's awesome.
Nima was really cool.
Yeah, yeah. And he's just a normal guy. And he's very good at physics, and he's a great teacher, and he's a good mentor.
And very down to earth, and like, just, I mean, I remember very much, like, when I was having this crisis of confidence, this thing where I was like, do I want to become, is this right for me? And I was, like, very anxious and very ashamed of it. And I told him, and he's just like, whatever, you know, figure out what you want to do and decide. It's totally fine. Like, no, you know. Certainly judgmental if you think, if you're, like, not, you know, if you're not applying yourself, or if you're, and if you're sort of, you know, trying to get by with second-rate work, but very, you know, very open other than that. Yeah, go ahead.
Between intellectual quality and being hardworking, which would you say is more important for someone?
I'm not sure that either one is. I mean, there is no substitute for hard work, and there's no substitute for having great ideas. Like, these are just,
right.
I think,
but
the two are often correlated.
In terms of intellectual quality, I actually think a lot of it isn't innate. It's whether part of your thought process is sort of challenging yourself and self-evaluation. So are you pushing yourself to be, you know, I think if I look at my colleagues and ask who's having more ideas, who's having more interesting ideas, maybe a little bit of it is that some people are like inherently smarter or more creative or whatever than others. But I think a lot of it is just who's actively making an effort at that, rather than and who's trying to become better at it.
I don't know anybody who has good ideas regularly who don't work really, really hard. Okay, I'm not a single person.
But it's not all nose to the grindstone. Some of it is just nose to the grindstone, get stuff done, you know, check. I mean, one thing that was really hard for me to learn was I saw people doing these, like, who could just do these estimates that made the calculations look easy. And I was like, oh, I should just learn to do these estimates. And I didn't realize until later, well, it was like my fourth year of grad school that Nima actually showed me these. So he was one of these people that just made estimating everything look easy.
Yeah.
And in all of our in all of the classes that he taught, it was sort of emphasizing these estimation methods. So I thought, oh, that's the way you should do it, right? And then at some point, there was some calculation that I wasn't just buckling down and doing. And he showed me his notebooks, like pages and pages of notebooks.
You know, stacks of notebooks.
From grad school. Where he just had worked through all these things in gory detail.
Yeah.
And he was like, yeah, you know, that's how I learned to do this stuff. You don't just learn to estimate by estimating.
It's like, are you crazy?
You learn to estimate by doing the calculations the really hard way again and again and again until you get a sixth sense for how they're going to turn out. Like, oh, why didn't you tell me that years ago?
No, I mean, seriously, there's like some people in the field, especially the sort of finely honed professionals, who make everything look easy. And so then you get this false impression And I don't want to overstate this, that it should be easy or that it comes totally naturally. Now, okay, there's clearly an element that some people are better at these things than others. Let's not disregard
right.
that. But it is also true that a lot of these folks who make things look easy worked really, really hard
to get to that point,
okay? And it's not like they're intentionally covering it up, but at some point the notebook's full of calculations go in the drawer and, you know, the offices become clear and, you know, immaculate, and all you ever see are these elegant, quick derivations of things on the board. And you're like, what the heck? You know, how did they get... But there's this hard slog that almost most of these people have gone through. So, sure.
If you had to give us one piece of advice, what would it be?
Do what you're interested in and do your best at it. Just do what you're interested in and do your best at it.
Yeah, I would agree, and that's two pieces of advice from two of us. So.
It's quite a general question, but. In your opinion, what are like the strongest, the best arguments for and against going to theoretical physics?
I think.
Four? Well, I don't know. It's a fairly unique experience to have ideas about the way the world works for the first time. It might actually be true. It's a lot of fun also to figure out how to test those ideas. I think that's pretty unique. Against, I think it probably is, there's an element of risk going into it. So if you're risk averse, then there's definitely an argument not to do it.
And I mean, the biggest risk is the risk that you work really hard, but you end up ultimately not, doing science is forgettable. Let's just call it that, right? You chose the wrong problems, and in the end, yeah, you've kind of learned something from it, but it turned out to be mostly irrelevant. That's a risk that you have to contend with. Obviously, there's a nearly 100% risk of sort of irrelevance to society. And so, I mean, this was part of my crisis was, do I want to do something that's more relevant to society? Or is it the sort of intellectual reward of maybe finding something new enough for me? I mean, look, I definitely think it's a career that comes from, or a vocation, really, that comes from a place of privilege that is supported in privileged societies. That, you know, smart people can spend their time thinking about these abstract questions instead of bettering the world. And that there's enough smart, well-trained people to do both.
The thing is,
The
thing is about theoretical physics, and this is true, these days it's true of a lot of science, that a basic R&D. Human beings are pretty smart. We've figured out a lot of things, and basic R&D has gotten out ahead in a lot of disciplines of technology applications, right? So, you know, so now when you look at science versus engineering and other things, depending on what kind of person you are, I mean, I think the thing you're alluding to is you can choose to go into areas where you have a very immediate, direct impact on people. And I think that's important to a lot of folks. And theoretical physics is not one of those disciplines. It just isn't. The ideas that we're talking about the way the universe works. We're talking about where it comes from. We're talking about what the fundamental laws are. And as we figure those things out, historically, that has completely changed the world. But it doesn't happen like this, right? So a lot of the ideas that we're uncovering, or a lot of the things we're figuring out, these are not going to be things that we can just put to market, you know, in a year or even a decade, right?
Right. And some of them may genuinely have no applications. Some of them may have applications that take a long time to figure out.
So first of all, it's an incredibly high impact in the long run. But I think a lot of the impact you probably won't see in your career. We'll go from right to left.
What are the qualities that a good experimental physicist versus theoretical physicist should possess? Like, what are the character traits?
I think a lot of them are similar in spirit. I mean, I think you have to be hardworking for both. You have to be creative for both. You have to sort of hone a sense of whether you're spending time on a dead end or a productive direction quickly. I think there's a certain kind of intellectual discipline that's really important in experiment, less so in theory. For example, if you're gonna, you know, and a long, certainly, so, but the, by which I mean that, that you want to make sure that you're analyzing the data in a way that's not too prejudiced by what you expect to find. That's really unique. Although actually there's an analog of that in theory too. It's just you're analyzing a theoretical problem to see what comes out rather than trying to force it in a particular direction. The biggest differences are things like the time scales of projects and just what kinds of day-to-day work you do. And there's sort of, I don't know, I think the hooks that engage you are fairly different between them. So the so experimental projects always take much longer than most theoretical ones.
You need to be a lot more patient.
Yeah.
And diligent and... I don't know. I don't want to say more because I think a lot of theory work, it's the same sort of thing. It's patience and diligence. And but it's just definitely true that in practice, most of the theoretical projects that people work on operate on a sort of few-month time scale, and most of the experimental projects that people in the community work on operate on a, well, a lot of them are a few decades.
At least a few years,
right?
Yeah.
There's nothing that I know of shorter than a few-year time scale on the experimental side. So.
So assuming that we're not really going for a tenure track position at the university, are there still opportunities for teaching?
Oh yeah.
Absolutely. There's teaching at a secondary school level. There's university positions that are teaching positions. They tend to be a little less, you know, financially secure than a tenured professorship at the same university, but still fine. I mean, in my opinion, a lot of universities don't treat these people well enough, so that's why I'm sort of, I'm not trying to degrade the position. I'm just trying to say it's not adequately compensated for what those people do. There's outreach programs like this one. I wish there were more. But there's a lot of different directions that you can go in terms of teaching.
But I mean, starting from physics, I mean, you're going to learn a lot about the way nature works. Probably even more important than that, you'll be forced to learn how to think analytically and, you know, size up problems, tear them down, solve them, right? You can take that and do just about anything you want. And then in terms of teaching, yeah, I think there's plenty of opportunities for teaching in physics. I mean, probably the higher impact teaching is probably at the high school level because a lot of the practical teaching positions at the university level, there's either the tenure track people who are teaching regularly, but then there's the teaching positions in universities. I would personally prefer the high school option, but
there's one of the Psy graduates that come on a master's program that went to Penn State to a PhD, and he decided it wasn't him, and he teaches a local high school not too far from here now, and he's a fantastic high school teacher. I think those kids are really lucky. So maybe we'll take a break for lunch, but Natalia and Philip have agreed to join us for lunch, so if you didn't get a chance to ask your question or you didn't really want to ask your question in front of everyone, you can definitely ask a question then, and I think they'd also be happy to answer science questions that perhaps are, we need to cover a lot of particle physics, so if you want to ask about the particle physics questions, you can bug them at lunch, but let them eat too. So let's thank them very much for taking the time.